Well, the show is Stand to Reason, and I'm your host, Greg Kokel, with you every, well, Tuesday night is the night when I broadcast from Southern California, Los Angeles area, from 4 until 6. That means during that time, you could dial 855-243-9975 and participate in our show. And we want you to do more than that, though. I mentioned about signing up for our Solid Ground and our mentoring letter, other things we're happy to send you at no charge just to mentor you so our team can mentor you and build you up as a Christian. Or if you're not a Christian, our team can annoy you in a good way and get you thinking about things that really matter. Some of you might not be aware that we actually have quick reference apps. I should say we have apps, and one of them is what we call a quick reference app. In other words, it's an app you can go to, and we have embedded in the app training sequences regarding basic things that we focus on, like being an ambassador for Christ, or tactics, or The Story of Reality, which is a book that I've written, and the basic Christian worldview, and other things like that. And so you could just quick reference. You can go there and, you know, at the stroke of your thumb or however you do it, you could find in our app something pertaining to an issue that you want to deal with right there. Very convenient, no charge for that. We also have another app. You can follow our blog, so you can follow our mentoring letters and our Solid Ground articles, and they're archived right there, and there's all kinds of things there. So it's easy. So I encourage you to consider all of those things in order to kind of stay abreast of what we're doing and what we are producing to help you be a more effective ambassador for Christ. And by the way, I just learned today that with STRU, Stand to Reason's online university, I think we have 3 courses up and still working on some more. We have 1,000 people, or close to 1,000. We're just about to breach that mark, and which means we got to upgrade our software. So many people are signing up for it. We're really, really thrilled to see that. And as we add more courses, more of you will be signing up and kind of doing the STRU, which is kind of like a Khan Academy approach. Some of you know what that is, but I think more fun. All right. And so I want to commend that to you. This hour, we're going to take calls the whole time. And I'm right in the middle of a conversation from last hour with Cade from Hibbing, Minnesota, up there in the, let's see if I get it right this time, the Iron Range.
You got it.
I got it. I'm still working at it. I still think of Rust Belt, but up there in the Duluth area of northern Minnesota, a lot of good fishing up in that neck of the woods, literally. Mm-hmm. So we were talking about your desire to maybe write a book that is geared for young people like yourself, and you're 13 years old, and taking apologetics and making some of these notions accessible to them so that instead of just being told to believe, they can be taught to believe. I sure like that concept.
Yeah.
Okay, that's really great. And I mentioned last hour a couple of notions. I said never start with nothing, which, by the way, notice that because there's an alliteration there with the N's, the repetition of the sound NN, never start with nothing, there's a certain rhythm and a sound to it that makes it memorable. Never start with nothing, okay? And that is an example of what I was talking about towards the end of our conversation of using aphorisms or trying to find a way to turn a phrase, so to speak, so that your point becomes easier to remember. And I cited Jesus a couple of times because Jesus did this all the time. And I think it's a good habit to get into. I mentioned a big bang needs a big banger. That's an aphorism. Okay. So
yeah.
Anytime you think of something clever like that, when you're talking to somebody else, just like we said last time, be sure to write it down. You never start with nothing when you have a project because you have been collecting things, ideas that you've had or sources or whatever pertaining to those things for a bit so that when you're ready to start writing, you've got something to work with, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I also said kind of along that line, never lose a thought.
Yeah.
Okay. So write it down. I actually have files, pages and pages and pages and pages of ideas, of reflections or maybe insights about a thing that I just put it in the file and I'll get to it later. You know, if you have something like Evernote on your computer, do you know what Evernote is?
I actually have never heard of it.
Oh, okay. Well, just check it out. It's free.
Okay.
Evernote.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, it's Evernote. It's a little green elephant icon. But it allows you to organize things according to different categories, and they allow you to do it with folders. But just saying, this will make more sense to you. Don't use folders. Use tags. Okay? I'm just saying. But but that's a way of, you can tag it, you know, evolution. You could tag it intelligent design. Then you put your ideas in there. And if you want to look up all the stuff you've saved on that issue, just go to the tag and there it is. Okay. So just a way of organizing information, but you don't start with nothing and you don't want to lose a thought. Okay. And that's where, your substance comes from. You know, you've already started with your outline of the kind of things you think might be interesting for kids. So you might think about, I don't know. I mean, apologetics is such a broad field that you might just think about, for example, some reasons why people would believe in God, young people, that, you know, that you'd want to offer them, or why should we take Jesus seriously?
Yeah.
Or something like that. So
the three main things I'm planning on covering is God exists, is your Bible trustworthy, and did Jesus rise from the dead?
Oh, perfect. Excellent. Super. Nicely done. Okay, so you got a good start there. Here's another thing that is going to be a little surprising to hear, but I hope it's an encouragement not only to you, but other prospective writers. I virtually never come to a writing assignment, Cade, without thinking that this is something I cannot do.
Yeah.
I promise you, I was telling Amy today, I've got a Solid Ground deadline coming up in about 4 weeks, and I have to do a third installment of this series that I'm kind of touching on this year. And I told Amy, I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know how to do this. I don't know what's going to go in there. So, you know, I do have notes and stuff that I can work with, but it is, when I got the contract for the story of reality.
Mm-hmm.
When you get a contract with a book publisher, especially if you've already have a track record, it's customary to get an advance on your royalties, okay? But you've got to produce a manuscript or else you got to give the money back.
Yeah.
I took the advance that Zondervan gave me and I put it in the bank and I said, I'm not going to spend this because I don't know if I can write the story of reality. This is the honest to God's truth. Now, of course, this book was finished in 2017, and it's, you know, done well, and I'm really proud of it. But honestly, when I started, I thought, I don't know if I could do this. The reason I'm saying this is because there are lots of people out there that would like to write that don't think they can.
Yeah.
And guess what? I don't think I can either.
Yeah.
All right? So that I don't want that to dissuade you.
Yeah.
All right?
Okay.
So
yeah.
I'm going to couple that with another concept that makes it possible for you to do it, and that the statement others have made the statement that creativity of some sort is usually like 10% inspiration and 90% perspiration.
Yeah,
I think the numbers are wrong. I think it's 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration.
Yeah.
Okay, now there is a have you ever read Pilgrim's Progress?
Pilgrim's Progress? No, I have not.
Okay.
I've dabbled with it, but I've not read the whole thing.
Okay, well, it is one of the most best-selling books of all time. Okay.
Yeah.
But the author in the copy I have, the author, I can't think of his name. I always balk at his name.
John something, I think.
John Bunyan. Okay. Derek just helped me out. Like he's Paul Bunyan's brother, I guess. I don't know. But John Bunyan, yeah. So he's writing in the foreword a poem about how hard it is to write. All right. And so I'm reading this poem, and he's got a line in there that I've actually written down, and I have it by my desk where I write. And he's bemoaning the labor of writing. And then he says this. But as I pulled, that was the verb he used, pulling, as I pulled, it came.
Mm-hmm.
And so I penned it down until at last it came to be this bigness that you see. Okay? So I think I left out a phrase or so in there, but you get the point.
Yeah.
John Bunyan, who wrote one of the most famous Christian works of all time, acknowledges how hard it was for him to write. He had to keep pulling and pulling and pulling and pulling. And that's the way I approach my writing projects. I look at it, I say, I can't do this. How am I going to do this? I don't know. Well, here, you start with this line. Here, take this. Work on this idea. Pull, pull, write it down. Write another sentence. Doesn't have to be fancy. Okay, what are you going to do with that sentence? You're going to pull on it. We're going to change it. We're going to move another one in its place. We're going to keep working these words around and just pulling, 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 perspiring, 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 and then at last it comes to be, for length and breadth, the bigness that you see.
Yeah, I like that. Well, speaking of publishing, Mr. Kokol, that's actually one of my concerns. If I were to get a manuscript done, where would I go to publish it?
Well, publishers publish. So there are actually two ways to do this, and one is the classical way of having someone invest their efforts in taking your manuscript and publishing it and putting it on sale. Okay?
Yeah.
The other way is to self-publish, which Amazon has a whole system that will help you to do that if you want to do that.
Yeah.
And that each has its merits and each has its demerits. The problem with getting published with a publisher is that they want to make a profit on their efforts, obviously. Okay? Mm-hmm. They want to make an impact with your book, but they want to make a profit. And so they're going to ask you as a writer, why would very many people buy your book?
Okay.
Okay, and that's nowadays, if you don't have a platform and a footprint, okay, like social media, organization, prior books sold, following of some sort, it's going to be hard to answer that question adequately for a publisher.
Yeah, that's what I'm a little afraid of, because I believe that self-publishing involves some of your own income input, and I don't know how much it would cost to do something like that, but I don't know if I would be able to do something like self-publishing.
Right.
So that's one of my concerns.
Okay, well, see, that's right. Well, that's when you're going to have to raise capital. And it might be shoveling snow, might be mowing lawns, it might be having your folks help out a little bit or something like that. But you're going to have to cross that bridge, because that's what it requires. It's either your capital or somebody else's capital.
Yeah.
That would be a publisher's, but then you got to convince them that you're a salable writer. My suspicion is that the thing that you're facing right now would be best to try to find a way to self-publish, and then in so doing, you now have a work of some sort. I mean, you'd have to market it yourself and all that, but you have a work of some sort that you can show to a bona fide publisher and say, look, here's what I did in the past. I'm capable of writing. I have another idea that maybe you'll help me with, and maybe you would have built a little following, okay? It certainly is possible for an unpublished writer with no platform to write a book that a lot of people want to read, especially if the market is open to that kind of thing. There aren't a lot of books for kids. Adam Wallace took his books and made some for kids, but there's not a lot. So that means there's an opportunity here, potentially.
Okay.
But this is what a publisher's going to want to see, okay? And we can talk more about this as time goes on. Here's what I would suggest you focus in on right now. Don't worry about the publishing end of it yet. Worry about writing it first.
Okay.
Even if you can't accomplish the publishing part, the writing the discipline of writing it is going to move you forward. So this is a craft, and Stephen King says writers write. That's what they do.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to become a writer, you got to write, and 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 you got to write. And then you're going to put, you know, as he did back then, you make offers and they get rejection slips and all that. And you keep at it until then you start getting something published, maybe something small, maybe something that is in some kind of Christian magazine. You just get an article published. They pay you $100 for it or something. Well, you're moving. So that's another option to keep in mind. You know, maybe it's a good idea to go and shoot for a smaller market than a book.
Okay.
All right. One last thing I'll offer here, and then we'll break it off. Maybe we can talk some more about it another time. But there are writers' conferences for specifically geared for young people. In fact, I took my daughter to one a couple of years ago. Now, the one I took her to was a writer's conference in, well, let's say the conference is a writer's conference, but it had a track for young people's writing. And there are other young people like yourself that were trying to break in and writing stories, and some were selling stories and some were selling books. Mm-hmm. So they tend to be fiction, not nonfiction, as I recall. But this was at, oh my goodness, I'm trying to think of it. It's in San Jose, not San Jose, but here I go, my senior moment again. What is that camp in the Redwoods there, Derek? Not Hume, in the Redwoods on the coast up by San Jose. Okay, well, anyway, you can type in Christian Writers Conference in your Google and see what they come up with. But maybe your folks who want to send you to something like that, and that's a way to rub shoulders with other writers and go to meet people and also to take classes that will help you kind of get published. So there's a couple things for you. What is it? Mount Hermon, the Mount Hermon Christian Writers Conference. Thank you. And right in the Redwoods there in Santa Cruz, California. So they have a famous conference. It's usually right around Easter time. So one coming up. And they generally have a young person's track, not children's, but who are writing different kinds of things. So I recommend that, Cade. Check that out. There's different ways to go about this, but I hope I've given you some ideas that will help you take the next step.
Yeah, that was really helpful. Thank you, Mr. Kokol.
You're really welcome. I mean, I'm glad to help out. And the big thing right now, don't worry about getting published. First, worry about writing something.
Yeah, okay.
And then that other, you can cross that bridge a little later on. You want to get some word count in front of you, okay? And that'll give you the confidence that you could produce a manuscript that someone might want to look at, all right?
Okay. Yeah, sounds good. Thank you, Mr. Kokol.
Okay, it's a pleasure talking to you, Kate. I look forward to our next time.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. All the best. All right, let's take a quick break, and we'll come back to, looks like I lost some callers. We'll come back to the rest of you, North Carolina and Australia. All right, Tobias, our buddy there from down under. Greg Kokol here at Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
Do you want to become a more knowledgeable Christian ambassador without sitting through a formal course on apologetics? Well, we've made that possible for you through our STR Quick Reference app. Available for free on iTunes and Google Play, the STR Quick Reference app holds a wealth of information summarizing what you need to know on a range of topics. Learn how to defend the faith, see how other worldviews compare to Christianity, and master the biblical view of morality, all through short, engaging videos. Before you know it, you'll be well-versed on a number of important apologetics topics. In addition, the Quick Reference app also includes a Bible with text and audio, as well as some featured STR resources, all to enhance your learning experience. The STR Quick Reference app will equip you to engage in thoughtful conversation about the key issues of life from a classical Christian perspective. Visit iTunes or the Google Play Store today and download the STR Quick Reference app. And if you enjoy the app, make sure you give it a 5-star review.
You know, if you've gained anything from listening to Stand to Reason, I'd really be thrilled to hear it from you. I love to take your questions, of course, but I also want your feedback. So here's what you can do. Head over to iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave us a rating and a review. That kind of thing really helps us to get the word out so more ambassadors for Christ can find the show and become equipped to stand confidently. And you never know, I might just give you a shout out on the air to show you my appreciation for your positive review. I value you as a faithful listener. I look forward to reading what you think about the show. Thanks. I just got word from Amy Hall that she tried to look up Mount Hermon Christian Writers Conference, which I went to first back in 1983, I think. And it was where I sold my first article. Apparently, they're not holding the conference this year. Maybe it's because of COVID. I mean, yeah, well, that makes sense. So just be forewarned, but other states may have Christian Writers Conferences that aren't as restrictive as the state of California. And if they do, then just check the lineup and see if they have a youth track. So that would be for Cade when he listens to this podcast, and others too may be thinking about that. That is a great conference, the best one, actually, in Mount Hermon, but it's apparently it's not on the calendar at the moment. All right. So let's go to North Carolina, and let me see if I get... Oh, gosh, I almost pushed the drop button. That would have been a bummer, Parks, if I did that, huh?
Well, I'm glad you didn't, Greg.
Yeah, I mean, I've done it before, but it's nice to talk to you. Thank you for calling and being so patient.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, and I appreciate you and Amy, just everything you talked about at the beginning. I appreciate y'all's wisdom and grace in talking about such a difficult thing.
Yeah, so, thank you. I'm glad to hear that that you responded that way. And it was difficult for us trying to navigate through that whole thing. Emotionally, it was really trying, but I'm glad that we kind of set our peace and were able to leave it behind us. So thanks for the kind words.
Yeah, I appreciate y'all. So my question really has to do with sort of coming from like a Christian perspective or a believer. Mm-hmm. Is belief in Darwinian evolution comparable to belief in inerrancy for a Christian? Like some people will say, well, and I mean I've heard you talk about this some too, like that inerrancy is not like for someone to be a Christian in inerrancy, like you don't read through scripture and find inerrancy in like as a belief of Christianity. Like obviously you wouldn't that
it's
wouldn't.
Not a foundational doctrine of the Christian
right.
faith in the way things like the Trinity and the blood atonement and all the other things are foundational doctrines. And so it doesn't show up in any church council. There is a presumption of inerrancy that makes it possible to formulate authoritative doctrine, but the doctrine of inerrancy is not one of those foundational doctrines.
You're right,
in that sense, correct?
Yeah. And so, like, I know there's a wide range of views on Darwinian evolution, and there's theistic evolution, and you know, and then there's intelligent design, mm-hmm. which is a response. And I mean, I don't hold the Darwinian evolution. I think it's a topic I want to read about more. But I think where I'm at, I have pretty good reasons to think that it's not the best view to adopt if you're a Christian. But I've, especially among some Christian philosophers, there just seems to be kind of this. Like they don't see belief in evolution as an issue.
Uh-huh.
Of course that's not all of them, but I've just been doing some.
So you want to know what I think about the weight of that concern for Christians in
yeah.
general. Okay. Yeah. I'm with you. I am not a fan of Darwinian evolution. My rejection of evolution though is based on the merits, the scientific merits, and not because I'm a Christian. Now, it is consistent with my Christianity to reject Darwinian evolution, but there are people who I have every reason to believe are committed Christians who believe the Darwinian account and offer that God used evolution in some sense. Now, I think that's hard to defend that biblically, and my question always in that circumstance is, if you think God used evolution, then tell me what you think he did. And the response characteristically is, well, God's working was undetectable. And I don't know why that's any different than just saying that the materialistic account of evolution is adequate to explain the complexity of life on Earth without God at all. So this is part of the concern I have about that general approach. Now, I think that there is a similarity between these two doctrines in terms of importance, which is, I think, what you're asking about, in that in both cases, as we noted with inerrancy, there has not been a classical historical point of view. The issue of God creating was central to Christianity from the beginning, obviously, but the fathers didn't talk about what that looked like. And it wasn't until the 19th century that Darwin shows up with the Origin of Species in 1859 or whatever it was. And so this is a more modern conversation. Okay, so in both cases, you don't have like an historical basis for the doctrines, because they weren't discussed as such. But they both have ramifications, though, it seems, for Christian thinking and for Christian beliefs, because the Darwinian model has been used to undermine the legitimacy of Christianity by showing that God isn't needed to explain the complexity of biological life. And therefore, one argument in favor of God is out the window, and that means that maybe more arguments in favor of God are going to go out the window too. And as science learns more, our need for God as an explanatory force is now, it's behind us. So that's the way that kind of whole thing works. So even though they're not foundational, they still are important. And I think I've talked about in the past how inerrancy has practical ramifications. I even hinted at it a few moments ago. Inerrancy is what provides us with the confidence to formulate doctrines that are true. Okay, God has spoken about these things, and therefore we can look at what God has said, and we can trust that God has said it, and so we can trust the information that we draw from the documents as being true about God himself. Now, are you asking me to do more than that? Just you want me to compare the weight of each one against the other?
Well, I think you sort of addressed kind of what I was thinking of, that I guess if somebody holds to inerrancy or they don't, if they hold to Darwin evolution or they don't, this can have other effects.
Other ramifications theologically. Correct. If they reject, if they hold to Darwinian evolution, the standard model, the neo-Darwinian synthesis, the molecules to man hypothesis, however you want to characterize it, okay, then this, I think, can have a corrosive effect on their theological convictions. Now, those who are theistic evolutionists say it's just the opposite. That is, if you accept Darwinian evolution, then the Bible becomes more plausible to non-believers, not less plausible. Frankly, I haven't seen that as the main impact. I think the main impact of Darwinian evolution has been to dissuade people of the Bible and of God's influence in the world, all right? When it comes to inerrancy, though, I think that inerrancy, when you reject that, it also there's a domino effect that what ends up happening is if the Bible is not inerrant, then we have to pick and choose what we think might be accurate. And that's when really foundational doctrines begin to topple, like the Trinity or the Blood Atonement. I mean, just look at the progressive church, progressive Christianity, who rejects inerrancy, and as a result of that, are now rejecting other core foundational doctrines of Christianity. So I think rejection of inerrancy is more problematic than an acceptance of Darwinian evolution. I think they both are troublesome in different ways, but I think the inerrancy issue is more pressing for sound theology.
Okay. Yeah, that's helpful.
Incidentally, Stephen Meyer has written a new book that's coming out in March, and I looked it up on I looked it up at Amazon. It's already a bestseller, and it hasn't come out yet, just in advanced sales. And we're going to have Stephen on sometime during that month probably to talk about it. It's called The Return of the God Hypothesis. All right. And so I got my copy in the mail, which isn't really a copy because they haven't been published yet. So I get the manuscript, and it's like a telephone book. You know, it's huge. But that's like Stephen, and he just goes full force with his ideas. But this, I think, is going to be another strong argument against the Darwinian model on the merits, on the scientific merits. And therefore, the God hypothesis has renewed vigor, you know, and renewed life in the minds of many people if the Darwinian model falters. So we'll see, but that'll be next month. I just thought I'd let you know about the book, The Return of the God Hypothesis. All right?
Yeah, no, that's thanks for telling me about that. I didn't even know we had a new book coming out.
Yeah, he's a crazy guy. His, you know, his the signature in the cell, this was his magnum opus, you know, when it happened. And since then, he's written two other books that are really significant. So this guy's like the Energizer Bunny, I guess. So anyway, so look for that next month. We'll have a talk with Stephen on that issue. Okay.
Well, thanks, Greg. Thanks for taking my call. And I'll just throw out that I'm a strategic partner and appreciate all you guys
great.
Do.
Thank you so much. And we couldn't do it without you guys, I'm telling you. Quite literally, we couldn't do it. We couldn't have the impact that we have without.
Well, we're happy to help.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Parks. And give my best to your family, too, okay?
Thanks, Greg.
Okay, buddy. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right. Now I'm looking at the numbers here. 17. Well, let me just go to Tobias. What the heck? And Brisbane. Is that how you say it, Tobias?
Hey, buddy.
Do you say it Brisbane?
I was just going to say yes. We it's a lot of people pronounce it America. They pronounce it Brisbane or Melbourne. It's just Melbourne or Brisbane. Just imagine the end of the bin.
I'm doing the best I can to speak the lingo there, mate.
Well, you're doing mate, so that's good. Listen, I've got a quick one, a complex one for you, but hopefully it'll make sense. Essentially, I want to figure out how to articulate when a fallacy has been committed in a specific argument. So to give you more context, there's recently there's this YouTuber called Professor Dave who has just recently released a video just attacking Dr. James Torr's views on, I think it's called abiogenesis. Oh, I can never say the word. But essentially just his attacking his science and everything. But there was one thing he included, which was a mathematical improbability equation. So essentially the argument from theist or apologists are that the probability of, say, the fine-tuning or a DNA strand or RNA to form a specific protein in that thing is less, it's more likely not than it happened.
Yeah.
Sorry.
That would be
the improbability is astronomical. Yeah,
yes, that would be an understatement. Correct.
Yes. Now, here's the interesting thing. It took me 4 days to process this. I am not really good at math, but it's second grade math in school, so really I had to chew on this. And I wanted to understand because I felt there was a fallacy he committed, but I didn't know what it was.
Right.
Essentially, the example he gave was, and just before I go into the example, it's what he's done is similar to, like, you know, when someone says, "Who created your eternal God?" The question by itself is valid, but when you apply it to that specific scenario, the question is invalid and nonsensical. Does that make sense?
That's right, because it's contradictory. No, by definition, an eternal God doesn't need creating. And
exactly.
So when you say it, when you put the question that way, it's a contradiction. And so that you can't answer an incoherent question. Right.
Yes. And what he did was, he had this example. I'm not going to read you the whole thing. I've sent a bit to Red Pen Logic to see if he can do an episode showing the fallacy. But
okay,
essentially, in
Tim
short,
Barnett.
In
right.
short, yes. In short, basically, what he's doing is he's saying, "Look, I can prove to you Christians and you people who say that these high improbabilities prove nothing. In fact." It does the opposite. It shows that I'll give you an example where something that happens all the time can have the same astronomical impossibility. And this is the fallacy he did. He basically said, let's say there's 10 people in a room and they all talking and having a good time, and then they start talking about birthdays. One says, oh, my birthday's on June 3rd. Another one's, my birthday's on March 23rd, and so forth. They all mention their different birthdays. But his logic is, he said, so essentially, each person has one in 365 chances to have that specific birthday. And then he does the equation and says, this astronomically impossible number. Yet, you and I and everyone knows that that will always happen. You will always, if you put any 10 people in a room, they will all have birthdays. So my understanding and my logic was, well, hang on a second. You've picked something that can never be impossible, using a mathematical equation that needs to see whether something is possible or not. People will always have birthdays. Does that make sense?
Well,
I don't know.
I kind of get in that particular one. I'd have to. You said it took you 4 days to figure this out. You know, I got about 4 minutes here. So I'm not sure entirely how to respond to that. I mean, there is no question that that highly improbable things happen. Okay, any particular hand that you deal from a deck of cards, any particular hand is highly improbable, okay?
Exactly, yeah.
But there's the hand. There it is, whatever it happens to be, the spray of cards. But the kind of argument, and actually Bill Dembski was the one many years ago who helped me out in this. It's not just the high improbability. It's it has to do with what Dembski called specified complexity. All right. Yes, these are highly complex things that are highly improbable. So any five card, you know, if you're playing poker, if you got five cards, any particular five card combination is going to have a certain complexity that is highly improbable. All right.
Yeah.
All right. But the key is not just the complexity, but it is the specified complexity.
Yeah.
All right. That is that the complexity is specified to another pattern. It matches another pattern. So let's just say I dealt you a hand in poker of the ace, king, jack, queen, 10, with 10, jack, queen, king, ace of hearts. Do you play poker?
Yes.
Okay. You know what that is, right?
Yeah.
That's called a royal flush. It doesn't get any better than that. There is no higher hand in poker. Is it highly improbable that that would be dealt somebody? Sure. But it's not any more improbable than any other mixture of cards. Okay? However,
yeah, I like this analogy.
Here's the key. Okay? And here's the key. Okay? So you have this that's really improbable. Okay? But it happens to be specified to another standard. It's a complexity that's specified, okay? What happens if I deal you those five cards and the next hand I deal the exact same five cards to you again? We shuffled, cut the deck, redeal, and you get another royal flush, or maybe worse, I get the royal flush as the dealer. Now, I could say, for me, getting a royal flush twice in a row is no less improbable than the cards you hold in your hand, right? Which mean nothing. I mean, there's just a spray of cards that have no relationship. They don't fit any pattern. However, the fact that I just dealt myself two royal flushes in a row, which is the highest hand in the game, that's suspicious. It's beyond suspicious. What you are going to think is there's no way somebody's going to do that by accident. Statistically, is it possible? Sure. Every single hand is statistically is just as statistically improbable, and the royal flush is no more so or less so than any other hand. But when you deal two of those together and they're specified to the highest hand in the game, well, the common sense person is going to say something's fishy here. All right. And what you end up having when you look at these complexities of life and the things dealing with DNA and all that other stuff, you have this highly specified information that is not just complex. It's specified to certain tasks to build certain things. They are blueprints, for goodness sake. Now, you could just argue, well, I know that's wildly improbable, but wildly improbable things happen all the time. But it's not just the wildly improbable. That's not the only feature here. It's that it's specified to a specific task to accomplish a particular thing. All these things
I'm
fit
with you,
together.
Yeah.
So and the classic example is you look at the, say, the rock formations in, what, South Dakota or North Dakota? I'm not sure. But in every rock formation is just as wild as any other. But then when you look at Mount Rushmore, you realize that rock formation is specified to different individual faces, you know, and because of the keen special specification there, it's clear that it's an example of intelligence. So if a person, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, like, you're answering the question not in the way I was expecting, but it actually solved the problem for me in a different way. Because what you're saying is, to me, is like, you know, you could look at this situation of going back to that mathematical equation. I think, and it came up from my brother, who's an atheist, who objected with this objection. And I was trying to say something doesn't sound right with it. Mm-hmm. But then the examples you've just given is the best way to actually show someone, if you don't believe that something could be highly improbable, you know, yes, we have these big numbers we don't understand. And then say someone throws that out as saying, well, like you said, random things happen all the time. So they're not really specified. But when you focus on specified examples, like, okay, here's a deck of hands, and I give you five royal flushes in a row. And are you gonna automatically assume that, yep, that happens, that happens every day, or are you gonna think that's something dodgy? I think that's more what I need to focus
on. If you go to the casino and there's the roulette table, and the odds that the little ball is gonna land in any particular number are exactly the same for every single slot, and they're exactly the same every single time they spin that roulette wheel, you know. So, but if you got the double zeros five times in a row, you would think it's rigged. And you could say, well, look at the roulette wheel doesn't remember what it did last time. No particular slot is any more probable or improbable than any other in any spin of the wheel. I mean, that's what the statistics say. However, common sense tells us when we see something happen like that, something else is going on. And it is not really bright to simply shrug it off like that and say, hey, you know, these kind of accidents happen all the time. That doesn't seem to be the best explanation for the way things are, you know.
And that's what you're hearing from that, from the atheist community who are so against this. I mean, I think what they're arguing is that these proteins and these sequences of RNA and DNA, and the fact that they say this to me sounds insane, but they say just because it seems rare doesn't mean it's not. It's happening. It's random because we see it happening, which is kind of a circular reasoning, if I understand that correctly.
Well, if they're presuming their point of view to explain the evidence, then that's circular reasoning. They're begging the question. But look at, here I got a sheet of paper here with ink on it, right? Came out of the printer, all right? These dots all, you know, that make up what I'm calling letters, there's a certain there's a certain configuration on the paper, you know. There's only so much space on this page and so much ink dots that can go on it. So you can actually calculate what are the chances that any ink dot would land on any particular spot on this page, right? But
exactly.
The thing
that's
is
a good one. I like that.
But you know, it's obvious as I look at these things spell words that have meanings. But the words and the meanings aren't part of the paper and the ink. Okay?
Yeah.
And it would be ludicrous if I tried to say, well, this looks like writing, but it's not. Okay? This is just dots, little pieces of ink fall in little pieces of paper, or little portions or locations on the paper. That's it. That's all you can say, and these things happen. Well, this is not an intelligent response. Intelligent people go with the odds-on favorite. That's what rationality requires. And this seems to fit a pattern on the page that communicates information to accomplish a task. That's what we read on the paper. That's what we see in the DNA. And if I can conclude the paper is a responsible, that the words are responsible, the result of a writer, it is entirely legitimate to make the same, draw the same conclusion about the information embedded in the DNA double helix. And there's nothing odd about that. And we are not stretching the truth in any way. It is actually the atheist who dismisses it as an accident that is really stretching the truth. In fact, even Richard Dawkins, who is probably the world's most famous atheist, right? He acknowledges when he looks at things like the fine-tuning of the universe, he says, we got lucky. You know, that's his bet. That's his explanation. And he does think it's a credible argument for God's existence, but he doesn't give that much credibility to it. He said this is one of the hardest ones to resolve because it just seems so implausible all of these things would happen by accident. But we just got lucky. Is that the best explanation for getting dealt five royal flushes in a row? I don't think so. I think there's another explanation that makes more sense. And that's the critical issue. What makes more sense?
No, and I got to thank you. That analogy with the piece of paper and the letters, that's exactly what he was doing. If you take jumbled letters, I'm sure you can work out an equation to show, well, that letter, the improbability of that being there, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about specified things, like
that's
that,
right.
An actual sentence forming.
That's
Listen,
right.
You've answered my question. I don't take any more time of you. Thoughts with you guys.
That's right.
I know we're all going through this.
You're the only one on, so it's okay for us to talk a little bit more. I wanted to draw attention. One more thing, though. This illustration I was using at the paper, I got that from Stephen Meyer 30 years ago. And he has stood in front of a small class when it was right when I was starting my MA Phil over at Talbot. And he held up the piece of paper and he said, I could know the physical qualities of this, everything about this sheet of paper exhaustively. I could be omniscient about everything, the physical properties and the ink and all this other thing. But with that omniscience of the physical thing, I will never know what it says. What it says, the information is not in the physical stuff. It is exemplified or tokened, if you will, represents, the token there on the page represents something invisible that's real. It points to it, and it does effectively if you know the language, okay? And that's exactly the same kind of thing we're facing when we look at the double helix.
Yeah. Yeah, see, that's good ways to kind of suggest to non-believers who believe just in the materials, like, well, hang on, if information is formed in a certain way and these all these examples of metaphysical things, is that what you're talking about?
Mm-hmm. Good point.
Yeah, it
yes.
points to
that's
something
it.
Outside the material, and it's a conversation I've had with some, I've got my brother and my friend who are very staunch atheists, and they'll hit me with these objections, and I'm like, I don't know how to answer this. It doesn't sound right, but have you ever considered that maybe this A, B, and C might be pointing to something outside the natural? And I've had this frustrating repeating argument with my brother where he just can't seem to, or maybe he doesn't want to recognize metaphysical things of how information is formed. And, you know, the old argument that Stephen Meyer says, the only thing that we know that produces new information is a mind.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's something like that that comes into play, and we can't use the tool of science, but we look at something like that, we should be going, maybe there is something more. Not saying that proves God exists, but just think maybe there is something more. That's fascinating, that example you used. So,
well, I think that the onus on us as thoughtful human beings is to find a solution or an answer that makes the most sense of the evidence. That's the key here.
Yeah.
So does it make most sense, for example, and I'll give you another illustration because, like I said, we got the time here, no worries. and here's, that's an expensive phone call from down under, so we're going to get your money's worth here this time. I suggested an experiment once, and the experiment is the chemist in the chemistry class, who's the professor, who's really good with precipitates and, you know, solutions, and he knows all of this stuff, so that if he has a beaker that has some precipitate in the bottom, like some solid residue in the bottom of this liquid, he's good to figure out what it is and where it came from. Let's just stipulate that, okay? So we said, okay, we're going to put you to the test here, Professor. We're going to give you a real hard problem to solve. And here's a beaker, and it's got, you know, a cloth over it. When we pull this off, we want you to do the scientific analysis to show us how this precipitate that you'll find in the beaker arrived there. All right, so that's the setup. So you pull the, he said, okay, let's go. And you pull the cloth off the beaker, and there in the water is an Oreo cookie. It's laying in the bottom of the thing. There it is. So explain to me your scientific process that he said, wait a minute, this is a joke, right? No, it's not a joke. He said, there's a cookie in there. There it is. It says O-R-E-O. You can still see it right on the deal. Yeah, we want you to explain in a scientific way how it got there. Well, I tell you how it got there. Somebody put a cookie in there, he says. And you say, foul, you can't do that. You've just implied intelligent action. You have an obligation to explain this precipitate in here by naturalistic causes only, or you violate the rules. He says, wait a minute, can't you see the cookie? You're wasting my time, he says, but notice how what we're trying to do is we're trying to reproduce this method that your atheist friends are using, that they're demanding that you explain everything in a materialistic way, even when the evidence is overwhelming that a materialistic answer is not adequate to the task. There's the cookie, O-R-E-O. It's obvious, right?
Yes.
So what we do is we go with the obvious explanation. That's what intelligent people do. That's called that's called common sense. All right.
Yeah.
And no special degrees are required to see the implications of this. But this is what your friends are doing, it seems to me. They are denying what is obviously before their eyes, and they are trying to conjure up some statistical counter-argument that says it is possible that all of this could be an accident. Well, okay, what if I just said, yeah, you're right, it's possible. Is it probable? Is it plausible, given everything we know? No, it's not for the best explanation for the way things are.
No, that's good, yeah.
So there you go. I mean, good luck with your brother, and I know these are hard conversations. My brother had a lot of conversations with me about this many years ago, and God eventually got through to me. And my dad became a Christian about a year before he died, and he's just about my age now. But, you know, and he was a crusty old guy, but God, and there was a genuine conversion. But you never know.
Yeah, well, we're praying for them. We're praying for God to soften their hearts. And like my brother is someone who's, he's got his own battles going on, and he's just very closed off to the idea.
Yeah.
I've read Is God a Moral Monster twice now to try and understand it, because he has a lot of objections. Where I've said to him the old classic line from Frank Turek, I said, Yoko, if Christianity were true, would you become a Christian? I'm just curious.
And
he said, no.
Yeah.
Because God's evil.
Yeah.
And so I went, okay, so there's a heart problem there too. So we're praying for him, and my other friend Johnny, he's fallen away from the church, and he's started looking at all this evidence to how religion's made up and Christianity's not true. And he's very, very smart. But at the same time, I always bring it back to, it's like, well, what do you believe?
Yeah.
You know, forget about the academic stuff. What do you believe, and what does your heart tell you? And then we try and hopefully have good conversations and just love on him and pray for him.
Hey, Tobias.
I'm hoping,
I have a question. We are getting a little short on time, so I want to toss this out before we go off the air. And that is, when a person who is an atheist raises the objection that the God that we are talking about is an evil God, I have a question. You might have heard me even ask this before, and maybe you've asked your brother this. Where are you getting the standard that you are using to judge God as evil? You're an atheist, right? Yes. You're a materialist, I presume. Yes. But you think there is a standard of objective right and wrong, and you're imposing it on God right now. So actually, there's two questions. Where did the standard come from? And if is the standard physical? Because you're in a materialist. Well, I think they're stuck in both of those, right? And I did have an atheist on my program that I talked with when he argued that morality comes from evolution, and that's a standard move. But of course, that can't be objective morality. That can only be a subjective morality that our genes have caused us to believe. And so
each gene is different. Yeah.
Yes. And so I asked him, he said, so what you're saying is that your evolution disagrees with what you read God did in the Bible. And he said, yes. And I said, okay, I rest my case. What else could I say? Who cares what your evolution tells you? Maybe somebody else's evolution tells them something differently. Once you go that route, you lose your grounds for the objection to God based on the problem of evil. Okay?
Yeah.
And so this, I mean, it might be helpful to ask that question. It's a fair question. And see what your brother says, you know. And I suspect he's not going to have a change of mind right away, but it might be another, you know, stone in his shoe to get him thinking and maybe moving in the right direction. So that goes to the grounding question about morality, which I know you understand. So I think it's a fair question to ask of him.
Niles, well, thank you so much for your time. As always, I appreciate you taking the time to chat to us and keep doing the stuff you're doing. And we really do hope and pray for you guys, especially now what's going on. And also, much love your way, mate, and have a good one.
All right, Tobias. All the best to you, brother. Bye-bye now.
Cheers, bye.
Yeah, thank you. Always great to talk to our friends down under, Tobias especially. And I went maybe for some of you a little quickly there, but whenever anyone says, who's an atheist, by the way, a materialist. Remember, materialists don't believe that anything exists that isn't made of physical stuff. If any one of those kind of people make an objection to our God because he's evil, well, now he's imposing a standard on God. He's measuring God by a standard. Where is that standard? It certainly isn't physical because you can't locate it in space. It doesn't extend in space. It doesn't have weight, doesn't respond to the laws of physics or chemistry. It's not physical. Secondly, is what gives the standard they're using to judge God any authority? Evolution isn't going to give you that authority. Anyway, that's a problem for them. Well, we made it to the end of the hour. It was great talking with Tobias Down Under, and thank you for staying with us here. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven, friends. Bye-bye now.